Today in Studio 360, a musical battle that continues to divide America.
Advance the flag of Dixie, hurrah!
A century and a half after the Civil War, we are still fighting over the song Dixie.
I wish I could quit you, Dixie. Seems like something that American culture would want to say to this song, but it's not going anywhere.
And our series on American icons continues today with a classic tale of a single girl's quest for the perfect man in New York City. No, it's not Sex and the City. It's Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth.
Just before I started writing Sex and the City, a girlfriend and I had read House of Mirth. We vowed that we must never end up like Lily Bart.
Plus, Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. A three-pack of American icons today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. For this Independence Day weekend, we're bringing you a triple helping of stories from our series on American icons. Stories about particular works of art and culture that keep us asking what makes us Americans and how we got this way. First up, Appalachian Spring. In the summer of 1942, the composer Aaron Copland took a commission of $500 to write the score for a new dance program for the choreographer Martha Graham.
Appalachian Spring is a joyous dance. It has its moments of darkness, too, but it is essentially joyous.
The libretto for Graham's dance follows a frontier bride and groom as they settle into their house and get to know each other and their strict new community. Over the course of the dance, the couple is visited by a revivalist preacher, a flock of four young female followers, and an experienced pioneer woman.
This is the story of a young married couple who are coming into their home for the first time. It begins in the daylight and ends with the evening when they're alone. The preacher is the itinerant preacher who teaches and preaches the evils that love can lead one into. And the followers are the ones who are charmed and seduced by him. And the pioneer woman is the one who has experienced all this before.
Martha Graham danced the part of the bride, and Merce Cunningham played the revivalist preacher who visits the young couple.
It's one of those coincidences, you could say it, that happening that was such a miracle.
Yuriko Kikuchi was another dancer in the original production.
It was a miraculous happening, Aaron Copland and Martha Graham together at that moment. For me, I'm 85 plus now, but still I get goosebumps when I think about the past.
In our ongoing series on American icons, we asked Jocelyn Gonzalez to look into how this miraculous happening created a work that really seems to define the American character.
Introductions aren't necessary.
No. Good afternoon.
Basically, you know, Aaron Copland is to American music what the Beatles were to Liverpool. And Appalachian Spring, you know, for most of America, was his Ed Sullivan show.
I assume everybody knows this piece.
Only by reputation.
It was the right piece at the right time, both the dance and the music. And when that kind of thing happens, a work takes on a momentum almost larger than itself.
In 1944, Appalachian Spring, the collaboration between composer Aaron Copland and choreographer Martha Graham, premiered in Washington, D.C. The American home front, just beginning to sense an end to World War II, took the dance and its music into its weary heart. It was a piece that expressed hope and possibility, despite the hard times and sacrifice still ahead. The dance went on to become a beloved icon in the Graham repertory, but it's Copland's score that's lodged itself in our collective ear.
He's been branded as a kind of American icon because he does capture both nostalgia and innocence and power.
Judith Tick is a music historian and a professor at Northeastern University. She's a co-editor of the book Aaron Copland and His World. She believes it was Martha Graham herself who inspired the score for Appalachian Spring.
Copland once described Martha Graham the way few people did. He said that there was something prim and restrained and simple yet strong about her which one tends to think of as American. So I think what Copland did was to project what he wanted this music to be onto her personality.
Not so sentimental, please, a more noncommittal. This is a little passage work here. Miss Graham is dancing.
Copland's score originally had to be written for 13 instruments because the pit in the auditorium at the Library of Congress, where the ballet debuted, was so small. Without the full orchestral vocabulary at his disposal, Copland had to strip down his sound, resulting in music that is as intimate and yet expansive as the themes of the dance.
Musically, he does that because the orchestration is very spare and lean. There's not a lot of romantic harmonies, not a lot of lush chords. It sounds like Charles Sheeler's very spare, lean drawings of Shaker chairs or Noguchi's rocking chair, which was on that set.
After the dance began touring to critical and popular success, Copland severed the score's connection to the ballet and rearranged it for full orchestra, removing sections too closely related to the ballet narrative. Appalachian Spring won a Pulitzer Prize in May 1945. Orchestras around the country began to pick it up as a concert piece. And finally...
Shall we try to record?
Yes, let's try it.
Stand by, please.
Bye. We're recording.
This is Appalachian Spring, take one.
Once it was recorded, it could be broadcast. People could buy it in their homes and they could listen. They didn't need to go and see the ballet with the piece. I like the opening of Appalachian Spring. I think it's a miracle. There's nothing but diatonic chords, revoiced, spaced out, and they just capture that sense of openness and vistas.
When we hear musical images that somehow seem to evoke within us the American landscape, whether it's urban or pastoral, those sounds emanate from Copland's work.
Pianist Michael Boriskin is the artistic director of Copland House, the site of the composer's home in Cortland Manor, New York. He says a young country like America is still constructing its cultural identity, so around the time of Appalachian Spring, American composers were developing a classical music tradition unique to the American voice. Copland is critically important to that emerging sound.
That's one of the reasons he turned to jazz and tried to graft the energy and dynamism of jazz onto a kind of European-based concert technique. And it really was only in the mid-1930s, encouraged perhaps by the hardships of the Depression, where a lot of kind of left-leaning artists felt populist impulses, and Appalachian Spring certainly is an outgrowth of that kind of artistic populism.
Appalachian Spring is designed to build to the appearance of Simple Gifts.
Terry Teachout is a music and dance critic.
And this is even more salient when you listen to the suite that Copland prepared.
That tune is the melody in Appalachian Spring that captures listeners' attention most often. It's based on "Tis the Gift to Be Simple," a religious hymn from the Shaker community. Copland discovered the song in a book of hymns published in 1940.
The heart of Copland's style is its deliberate simplicity. The word plainness comes up over and over again when people who knew him well talked about him. And when he encountered this Shaker tune, not just the tune, but the idea behind the tune, that was, again, one of these found objects that suddenly tells you something about yourself that maybe you didn't fully understand. And it had a tremendous effect on him.
It sounded like a nursery rhyme.
As a kid growing up in Detroit, composer Patrick Grant came across Copeland's Simple Gifts on one of those Sunday afternoon classical music radio shows.
And because it sort of follows all the rules of other nursery rhyme music, like the melody is just within an octave, all the intervals are relatively close together, which makes it very singable, and it's just based on a couple of chords. Simple Gifts is basically a march in terms of its meter, its tone. Melodically, the whole piece is just a big arc form. It just goes up and goes down. All within an octave.
U.S. presidents from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have used Appalachian Spring in their inaugural celebrations. Marshall Blonsky, author of American Mythologies, thinks Copeland's repeating variations on the Shaker tune may explain why it's used so often in public functions.
It's martial music, and all martial music has no tragedy in it, has only the swelling of the heart. And when Copeland orchestrated the Shaker lyric, he changed it from simplicity to a rousing, patriotic march. Signified by this orchestra is the community, the nation, all as one.
That's what we would like. It's about what we wish, not necessarily what is. Copeland's influence spread right into movie scores.
Music historian Judith Tick.
I think the score for The Best Years of Our Lives, a film about homecoming that Hugo Friedlander did, was a good example of his influence. And I think composers like Philip Glass acknowledge his debt to Copeland, and certainly John Adams. They don't imitate. They absorb both vision and ambition.
Spike Lee's 1998 film, He Got Game, intercut the gritty rap music of Public Enemy with various selections of Copeland's music. The film is about a father and son playing out their strained relationship on the basketball court. The story opens with a camera panning down from an endless blue sky to a young man shooting layups on a city court. His muscular body twists in midair, suspended on those famous open chords.
Even artists who are not themselves composers, somebody like Spike Lee, will encounter this music for the first time, often in adulthood, and say, oh my God, this is where it all comes from. And then he draws on it as soundtrack material for a film.
Reminiscent of those dancers in the original production, watching this athlete spin and leap to the strains of Appalachian Spring, there is again a sense of possibility.
Appalachian Spring, both the dance and the music, they speak to our better selves. And I think especially in a country like America, which is self-created, this is the quintessential American theme.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
You can find out more about Appalachian Spring and the dozens of other American icons in our series at studio360.org. Still ahead on this special American Icons Hour of Studio 360, a very different and highly contentious piece of American music. It's been a hit for more than 150 years, and Dixie continues to drive people crazy.
That caused conflict within me. When I heard the song, music tends to do that, tends to motivate, it stirs the emotion. Those are the emotions that I felt. It caused the conflict.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. American icons aren't just popular. They've got power over us.
It kind of shows you the degree to which art and design can really control and manipulate people. In the world of Disney, the artist is God.
From Disneyland to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, stay tuned for a brand new season of American Icons coming this fall. When you
wish upon a star. Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. This month is the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. The state of Pennsylvania has been commemorating with reenactments and a Remembrance Day parade. Most of the ephemera from that age is in museums and other collections, behind glass, posters, uniforms, photographs. But two symbols of the Confederacy are alive and kicking, the Stars and Bars and a song that's still as hot today as it was then. You've heard it on TV, maybe even walking down the street. It's Dixie. It is an American icon, and we asked Studio 360's Trey Kay to find out where Dixie came from and how it continues to divide Americans.
On April 4th, 1859, while the clouds of war were gathering in America, Bryant's minstrel show, performing at a Broadway theater in New York City, was about to inject one of the most memorable and ultimately most controversial songs into the nation's bloodstream.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my pleasure to present a new ballad written by Mr. Tambo, and I must say, against the advice of his friends. It is entitled Dixie.
This scene from a 1943 film called Dixie, starring Bing Crosby, tries to recreate the song's debut.
I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times I am not forgotten. Look away.
Did you catch that? When Crosby, who is in blackface, sings Old Times Dar Am Not Forgotten, he's imitating a slave dialect, as written by a white man from Ohio.
It's a white person dressed as a black person longing for the plantation south.
That's Coleman Hutchison, professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He devotes a lot of ink to Dixie in his book, Apples of Ashes, Literature, Nationalism, and the Confederate States of America.
The idea is that this person who's singing is away from Dixie, which we understand to be somewhere in the South, and that the person is really crying out to be back there, wishing that they could be back, nostalgically wishing they could be back on the plantation, away, way, way down south in Dixie.
This is why many people have always regarded Dixie as racist. With its happy depiction of plantation life, it seems to apologize for slavery. We can't say precisely who wrote Dixie. Daniel Decatur Emmett, a white minstrel songwriter, most often gets the credit. But Coleman Hutchison and other scholars think that he might have lifted parts of it from African-American folk tradition and invented verses of his own.
One of the things that Emmett's most famous for is his ability to record the purported sounds and rhythms of black speech. So this is a man who made his money arranging and writing songs that would stereotype and in some ways mock African-American speech patterns, African-American culture.
Hooray, hooray,
Dixie went viral. And although the North and the South were about to go at each other's throats, whites all over the U.S. loved Dixie. Abraham Lincoln had the song played at his inauguration. When the Confederates were voting on secession, the band played Dixie after each vote in favor. And when Jefferson Davis was inaugurated, the song was arranged to a quick-step beat, something you could sing while marching off to war. And it got lots of new verses.
Southerns, hear ye country, call ye up, lest worse than death befall ye. Two arms in Dixie.
This is a Confederate version. It pledges to live or die for Dixie. It was recreated by a musician named Bobby Horton.
Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand and live or die for Dixie.
And the Union had their answer. Again, here's Bobby Horton.
Away down south in the land of traitors, rattlesnakes and alligators, right away, come away, right away, come away. Where captains, king, and men are chattels, Union boys will win the battles, right away, come away, right away.
Each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam.
Each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam.
But that Yankee version didn't stick. A Northerner may have written Dixie, but it perfectly captured the warm sentiment Southerners felt for their homeland, even if they didn't live in cotton country. Dan Emmett, a Union man, was none too pleased.
So he will say on a number of occasions that he wished he'd never written the damn song in the first place, because if he had only known what the Confederates would do with it, if he'd only known what Southerners would claim with his song.
When the Bloody War finally came to a close, Lincoln asked the band to play Dixie at victory celebrations. Coleman Hutchison reads the remarks that Lincoln made at one occasion.
I thought Dixie one of the best tunes I ever heard. I had heard that our adversaries over the way had attempted to appropriate it. I insisted yesterday that we had fairly captured it. I presented the question to the Attorney General, and he gave the opinion that it is our lawful prize. I asked the band to give us a good turn upon it.
It sounds like Lincoln is sticking his vanquished enemies in the eye. But Coleman Hutchison sees it a little differently.
I think he's really reaching out there, yes, to tweak the South a little bit, yes, to acknowledge that the Union had won, but also acknowledging a certain common culture in which the president of the Union, who has just brought to the end the bloodiest war then known to mankind, can also acknowledge an affection for the South and a willingness to work to bring it back together.
But Lincoln was wrong. The North had indeed won the war, but it couldn't claim Dixie. In the Reconstruction era, as Southerners became nostalgic for the antebellum way of life, they got even more attached to Dixie. Confederate heritage organizations decided on a standard version based on Emmett's original verses. But they made one important change. They removed the corny slave dialect because it wasn't about slave life anymore. It was more about Southern pride. Long into the 20th century, Dixie was popular throughout the nation, sort of like Gone with the Wind. But as the civil rights movement began to make inroads in America, Dixie was a front in a new battle. The Virginia Military Institute is in Lexington, Virginia, situated in the majestic Blue Ridge Mountains. Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee are buried close by.
When you passed Lee's tomb, you were required to salute the flag. And I know the way I got out of that is that I very seldom passed Lee's tomb.
That's Colonel Philip Wilkerson, retired from the U.S. Army.
I attended VMI as one of the first five African-American cadets.
Every May, VMI has a commemoration ceremony for its cadets who died in the Battle of New Market during the Civil War. They helped secure a Confederate victory. For about 100 years, Dixie was a part of that ceremony.
The negative connotation that Dixie held for me, it was associated with the Ku Klux Klan. It was associated with lynching. It was associated with mistreatment of individuals, not only blacks, but Jews and a bunch of other. That caused conflict within me. When I heard the song, music tends to do that, tends to motivate, it stirs the emotion. Those are the emotions that I felt. It caused the conflict.
In 1973, after Wilkerson graduated, the student body voted to eliminate Dixie from the Newmarket ceremony.
One song does not take away from the valor of those cadets. The student body realized what's more important, playing a old, outdated song or keeping cohesion within the Institute. And I think clearly cohesion within the Institute took precedence.
And this, in the eyes of some, is tantamount to cultural genocide.
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive. It's a form of cultural genocide in that it's stamping out a culture that really is not a threat to anyone.
Glenn McConnell is Lieutenant Governor of South Carolina. When the Citadel, another famous Southern college, stopped playing Dixie at sporting events in the 1990s, McConnell was critical.
If we become intolerant and we start excluding things, we're on a slippery slope. And it eventually erodes that part of history, that part of the culture. Racism has occurred north and south and everywhere. And you can't change what occurred, but you can grow from it. And I don't think growing from it is excluding it. Because what happens is when you deny somebody that which they cherish, then that builds up resentment. And that's just not a good way to go. I just think the cement of a free society is toleration and incorporation.
I'm Carol Mosley Braun. In 1993, I was the United States Senator from Illinois.
In 1993, Carol Mosley Braun was the only African-American in the United States Senate. She was locked in a power struggle with Jesse Helms over the Confederate flag. It was a technicality having to do with the patent on the flag, but symbolically, it was big. And Mosley Braun was winning the fight against the legendary Jesse Helms.
The next day, I was on the Senate elevator with Senator Hatch and Senator Dodd, and the door opened and Senator Helms started to come onto the elevator, and he said to Orrin Hatch, he said, "I'm going to make her cry. I'm going to sing Dixie until she cries." And I responded, "Senator, you could sing Rock of Ages and I would cry." Did I take it as a jocular kind of, you know, let's be friends? No, it was not. It was intended to be hostile, and it was intended to be aggressive. I don't mean to speak ill of the dead because, as you know, he's dead now. But the fact of the matter is that he was part of a cadre of senators who had made a career out of fanning the flames of racial antipathy and antagonism and using that as a way of building their own constituency by exploiting racism.
Can Dixie ever shed that Jesse Helms fanning the flames baggage? The controversy isn't fading. In 2009, the University of Mississippi banned the song, but Coleman Hutchison, the University of Texas historian, thinks that we should be careful about dropping Dixie, even if we find it offensive.
By studying Dixie, I think we get an extraordinary opportunity to see the history of the last 150 years, from blackface minstrelsy to the inauguration of Barack Obama. Dixie has been a major cultural thread that can connect those disparate historical moments.
Hutchison thinks that Elvis had the right idea. Yes, Elvis Presley. Elvis began performing a version of Dixie in the early 1970s. But the arrangement, by songwriter Mickey Newberry, gave Dixie a chaser, the battle hymn of the Republic.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Beautiful performances like Elvis's help us to continue to have an ongoing relationship with the song, help us to continue to find a place for it in our lives, our ways of thinking about the U.S. South, about the nation, about slavery, about racism. You know, I wish I could quit you, Dixie. Seems like something that American culture would want to say to this song, but it's not going anywhere.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kidd.
You can hear still more versions of Dixie at Studio360.org. And while you're there, check out all the other American icons in our series. Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, the Harley Davidson, the autobiography of Malcolm X, and many, many more. That's at Studio360.org/American Icons. Coming up, it's got money, intrigue, secrets, passion, everything but a happy ending.
It has all the attributes of a romance. You are seduced by this notion of happiness and delight, and the end is so shattering.
Inside Edith Wharton's groundbreaking novel, The House of Mirth. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, we introduced our latest extra credit listener challenge, Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
We're asking you to send us the best piece of music you made between your freshman and senior years of high school. It doesn't matter whether you were in high school when Elvis or Prince or Jay-Z was at the top of the charts. We want to hear your songs. We've already gotten more than 100 tracks submitted to our SoundCloud page. Everything from punk to metal to folk to indie pop and more.
She is so far above us all. Right? Anna is a god. She looks so mod in her big fraud. Right? Anna plays it cool, so the boys drool when they see her. It's kinda making me mad. It's kinda making me mad. And the girl on the magazine looks so serene. Nobody can help but know her name.
Think your band rocks harder? Post your track for our judges Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen. They're going to not only pick the winner, but perform a cover of the winning song. And while you're reminiscing about how awesome you looked on stage back then, go ahead and send us your best band photo. Check out the ones we've already got at studio360.org/myhighschoolband. The deadline for the contest is July 21st. In today's hour of Studio 360, we've been listening to stories from our series on American icons. Now it's time to meet Lily. Lily is a smart, witty single woman and absolutely gorgeous. She's at Manhattan parties almost every night, But Lily's also anxious. She's turning 30 and struggling to manage her money, her friendships, her romances. But this is not Sex and the City. It's New York in the 1890s. And Lily is Lily Bart from Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth. The novel appeared in the fall of 1905 and sold 140,000 copies its first year, an enormous bestseller for the time. And although the social world the book depicts is pretty much gone, the novel feels strangely modern a century later. In this segment from our American Icon series, Studio 360's Michelle Siegel steps inside the House of Mirth.
So, how many times have you read the book?
Probably 20 times or more. I've read it so many times, and every time I see something different in it.
I've studied it.
I did fall in love with it because of not only the marvelous use of English, I mean, it's wonderfully written, but it is the most savage satire.
It has all the attributes of a romance. You are seduced by this notion of happiness and delight, and the end is so shattering.
The House of Mirth opens in Grand Central Station. It's where the bachelor Lawrence Selden spots Lily Bart.
Selden had never seen her more radiant. Her vivid head, relieved against the dull tints of the crowd, made her more conspicuous than in a ballroom. And under her dark hat and veil, she regained the girlish smoothness, the purity of tint that she was beginning to lose after 11 years of late hours and indefatigable dancing.
Here's what you need to know about the book. It's New York City just before the turn of the 20th century. Lily Bart is 29 years old. Her parents have died, and her family money is gone. Her beauty is beginning to fade, the very looks where her value lies. A wealthy aunt takes her in, but Lily's spending and gambling habits go far beyond her allowance. The House of Mirth chronicles Lily's quest to find a husband, and fast. For Lily, this means saying yes to every social function.
She looked down the long table, studying its occupants one by one. How dreary and trivial these people were. Lily reviewed them with a scornful impatience. Carrie Fisher with her shoulders, her eyes, her divorces. Young Silverton, who had meant to live on proofreading and write an epic, and who now lived on his friends and had become critical of truffles.
Nothing is said, nothing overtly savage happens. But below the surface, you know, I mean, you're in deadly danger from the moment you get up till the moment you go to bed. And that's what's terrifying.
Terence Davies wrote and directed the 2000 film adaptation of The House of Mirth. He took a lot of his dialogue straight from Wharton. In this scene, a friend warns Lily about the backstabbing ways of their mutual acquaintance, Bertha Dorset.
Oh, I don't say there's any real harm in Bertha, but she delights in making people miserable, especially her husband. Poor George. But she is dangerous. And you're not nasty. And for always getting what she wants in the long run, commend me to a nasty woman.
I thought you were so fond of Bertha.
Oh, I am. It's much safer to be fond of dangerous people.
The upper class here is gross and animalistic and horrendous, totally immoral.
Hildegard Huller teaches American literature at the City University of New York.
Wharton calls it the tyranny of the tea tray. You know, the minute the tea tray comes into the room, everybody has assigned roles. Certain things can no longer be said, can no longer be done. Everybody has to perform according to that tyranny.
The book had all the trappings you'd see in a novel of manners, like something from Jane Austen, but with an edge. Wharton was one of the first American novelists to write about money and class. With finance capitalism on the rise, people were getting rich quickly, not just inheriting their wealth. In The House of Mirth, old money clashed with new. It made the novel a sensation. And writer Roxana Robinson says American readers hadn't seen a tragic heroine like Lily Bart before.
Well, I would compare it to Anna Karenina. There was this notion of the upper classes, the classes of privilege. And when they were written about, they were perceived as conquerors and triumphant. So those endings were usually happy. And to have this interior view of a world that most people only saw from the outside and to see the extraordinary pain that could be felt there was just a revelation, I think.
Robinson first read the novel as a teenager. She had a glamorous aunt, a former model who worked at Vogue, who turned her on to the book. Robinson immediately related to the endless social rules Lily has to obey. The suffocating world depicted in the book was also Edith Wharton's reality.
She was still stuck in this circle of people who judged her on the length of her skirt and the set of her shoulders.
A woman is asked out as much for her clothes as for herself. The clothes are the background, the frame, if you like. They don't make success, but they are a part of it. Who wants a dingy woman?
Wharton was not a beauty, and she wasn't rich. So it wasn't for 6 years that she became engaged, and he wasn't a catch. Edward Wharton was 12 years older than she was. He'd never had a job. He lived with his mother, and his father was in an insane asylum. Writing saved her sanity, and certainly was her greatness, but she still was held a prisoner in a marriage and a life that she couldn't escape from.
So it's not an autobiography of Wharton, but it is like an emotional autobiography of her.
Yes. She was writing in The House of Mirth about what happens to a woman who loses that central vein of forward motion. There's nowhere for her to go. So I think in that way, she's not punishing Lily. She's saying, this is what it feels like to me. I am devastated and I am suicidal.
Everything in the past seems simple, natural, full of daylight, and she was alone in a place of darkness and pollution. Alone. It was the loneliness that frightened her.
Some modern readers might dismiss this as turn-of-the-century chick lit, but Edith Wharton wasn't just making entertainment. She took a risk in writing seriously about women's lives and emotions. Through Lily, she posed questions women and men still ask. How will we lead our lives? What will become of us? And Wharton didn't stop there. She critiqued the society she lived in. She exposed how it treated women and how it was governed by money, class, and taste.
Every couch, every pillow, every meal is about the sense of entrapment and the sense of being determined by those things. And taste is something you can't acquire, even though you can have the money, but you can't have the class because you don't have the taste.
Lily's goal is to keep her footing in the upper class, but the very notion of class that Lily aspires to, well, it was becoming nostalgic. This plays out in her relationship with Sim Rosedale. He's a successful investor and single, but he's an outsider because he's Jewish. Rosedale needs Lily to help him climb the social ladder. Early on in the novel, Lily is repulsed by him. She rejects his advances. A year passes, and she's in a much more desperate situation. She tells him she's ready to marry him. But now, he sees things differently.
Miss Lily, what I mean...
What you mean to say is that I am not as desirable a match as once you thought me.
You know as well as I do, last year you wouldn't look at me. Now you appear willing to do so. What's changed in the interval? Your situation. Then you thought you could do better.
You think you can?
Yes, I do.
I mean, all of Edith Wharton's books are about money. There's an exchange in every single encounter. It's an exchange of value.
In the 1990s, Candace Bushnell began to write about the same themes, first in her newspaper columns and then in her novel, Sex and the City.
The exchange of being seen with the right person will elevate you in society. There's always a tit for tat. And that is still very, very true in New York society. It goes on under the surface or it's blatant.
What are you getting so uptight about? I mean, money is power. Sex is power. Therefore, getting money for sex is simply an exchange of power.
Don't listen to the dime store Camille Paglia.
I don't know whether to take it as an incredible compliment or as an incredible insult.
Just take it, period.
Well, the Sex and the City TV series was based on Bushnell's book and starred Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie Bradshaw.
You guys, I'm gonna write the whole thing off as a bad date with a cash bonus.
Bushnell had very early on try to kind of position herself with Wharton, really, as something of a kind of social commentator on this milieu of privileged New York society. They kind of move in broadly similar circles, 100 years apart.
That's Deborah German. She lectures on contemporary television at Roehampton University in London.
What's interesting about both Lily and Carrie, they're both kind of really caught up in that world and seduced by that world, but they also stand outside it sometimes and criticise it and feel uncomfortable in it.
Younger and plainer girls had been married off by the dozens, and she was 9 and 20 and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate when she longed to drop out of the race and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be?
What if Prince Charming had never showed up? Would Snow White have slept in that glass coffin forever? Or would she have eventually woken up, spit out the apple, gotten a job, a healthcare package, and a baby from her local neighborhood sperm bank? Couldn't help but wonder.
So does it surprise you that in this respect so little has changed? I mean, so much has changed in 100 years, but also so little?
Well, although women have clearly moved on, you know, underneath it all, there's this kind of continuing strand of the difficulty of what marriage represents for women, the difficulty of kind of gender inequity that still exists between men and women, despite the fact that women clearly have, you know, careers that they couldn't have dreamed of 100 years ago. What Walton kind of shows is how difficult it is for women to maintain or pursue close friendships. By the time we get to Sex and the City, key difference is that you know, women are able to kind of celebrate their friendships together.
Don't laugh at me, but maybe we could be each other's soulmates.
Well, that sounds like a plan.
Just before I started writing Sex and the City, a girlfriend and I had read House of Mirth, and we vowed that we must never end up like Lily Bart. It was kind of eye-opening that if you are kind of hoping that in some way you're going to be saved by society, you really may not be.
By the end of the book, Lily gets fired from a hatmaker's workshop. Her stitching just wasn't up to snuff. And so with very little money left, she's forced to live in a boarding house.
Her whole past was reenacting itself at 100 different points of consciousness. Where was the drug that could still this legion of insurgent nerves? She put out her hand and measured the soothing drops into a glass. But as she did so, she knew they would be powerless against the supernatural lucidity of her brain. She had long since raised the dose to its highest limit, but tonight she felt she must increase it. She knew she took a slight risk in doing so. She remembered the chemist's warning. If sleep came at all, it might be a sleep without waking.
Lily Bart doesn't wake up.
What do you do if you think you know the rules and then you don't and you're destroyed by them? But in that process, you find that you have moral integrity.
This character whom you have come to live in as yourself, you live in Lily Bart's mind.
We identify with her weakness. And most of us are quite entrapped ourselves. We want fashion. We want to be beautiful. We compromise ourselves.
And you're so hoping that she's going to find the pinnacle of the life that she's capable of. And it's so devastating to see her descend from those heights. And to realize that Wharton constructs this perfectly. There is no other ending that's possible for Lily Bart. There's nothing else.
Edith Wharton created a breakthrough novel, and The House of Mirth was her personal breakthrough, too. She was 43 years old when it was published, and it gave her success and freedom she'd never had before. And in 1920, she won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, a first for a woman, for her novel The Age of Innocence. Towards the end of her life, Wharton wrote an autobiography. It's called A Backward Glance, and in it, she tells a story about her time as a war correspondent in France during World War I. She went to ask a French official for permission to go to a battlefield, and the official refused her. But then he went to go talk to the general, and when he returned, he says to Wharton, "Are you the author of The House of Mirth? Because if so, the general says, you can have a pass." For Studio 360, I'm Michelle Siegel.
You can see the first edition of The House of Mirth and hear the novelist Jonathan Franzen tell me why it's one of his all-time favorite books at studio360.org/American Icons. Anne-Marie Nest read from the novel. And that's it for today's show. If you liked what you heard from our series on American Icons, we have a whole fleet of new ones coming this fall, including One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Anything Goes, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and more. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Special thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
Down at the shore, there's a place where there's no one vacation.
We get sand in our toes with They Might Be Giants.
Coney Island and Asbury Park, they're always getting the like, oh, it's coming back. And you never know what to think. Is it really going to come back?
Was it ever there?
Right?
Culture on the Beach, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.